Now is our
final speaker for the session is Vladimir Bulovich from MIT's Department of Electrical Engineering and Computer Science. And he'll be telling us about his group's efforts in designing and constructing solar cells and lighting devices.
Since we coordinate our talks, we also make sure that we repeat at least half the slides to remind you of the most important points. I'm not going to repeat really half the slides, I will repeat a few, but for the sake of emphasizing the couple of things that were not said before. I love this picture as well, and I love it for the couple of reasons. I think it very clearly states whose responsibility is to figure out how to make more energy. It's us. We indeed use the most, about a quarter, and they're only about 5% of the population in the United States. That's a good thing to think about. The other thing that's very striking to see, for example, North Korea, right? It's right there. You can easily figure out the well-being of a nation. There's a South Korea, the bright light bulb underneath. You can very easily figure out the well-being of a nation by checking out the brightness quality of lights that they use or the use of energy inside the actual country. And so, is there a trick here? Oh, there we go. No?
Because, I'll let battery out of this one in case it's talking online.
You better just roll it.
Oh, just roll it.
Perfect. On the side.
Perfect.
The blackboard.
Roll down. All right. So the metric that you should really look at is the fact there we use about 3 terawatts of energy, and Dan has gone through the detailed analysis on how that comes about. One thing you also should recognize is that, you know, an average per capita use in the United States of energy is about 13 kilowatts. Well, that's how much you spend on average day. About half of it is due to electricity. You actually only use about 1.6 kilowatts of electricity, but there's an extra 5 kilowatts that will be spent as heat to make that electricity for you. So, roughly speaking, half the energy of what you spend is in the electricity per capita. Now, the other kind of graphs to point out is indeed, this is the population maps per country, and then this is the energy use per country. U.S. becomes very, very big as you go from one to the other. Now, hopefully I motivated you that you need to figure this out because it's up to us. All right, so now the other reason to look at this is to say, well, okay, the well-being of a nation indeed goes as the GDP per, as the energy use per person. Skip to these quickly. So there's something called the Human Development Index, and you can say it actually relates to the annual per capita electricity use. U.S. and Canada are quite well off, and so are most of the other green guys. But the essence of it being that, again, if you want to uplift the world, let's come up with the ways to come up with a cheap energy source. All right, cheap energy source. There is a problem with our present cheap energy sources, and we think it's the CO2 rise. I love this particular picture, which is the cut of one of these glaciers that are on the equatorial mountains. And you can see just like a layered cake, brick and mortar, right? You can see the ice separated by a small amounts of dust. And each one of these is a year of ice, of snowfall accumulated, consequently by drilling through and by simply reading off the number of these rings, you're going to be able to figure out exactly what year you're in and consequently read off the CO2 levels. You're going to be able to read off the temperature as well by looking at the ice itself. And so you actually take a look at this over 400,000 years, Dan pointed this out, we're kind of high today compared to the way we were over the past 400,000 years when it comes to CO2. Now, you can say we should worry about this, and some people do. They say, well, where does the CO2 come from? Well, one way of explaining CO2 is indeed by going to Hawaii, where there is no coal plants per se, or not too many, and reading the air and measuring the CO2 in there. And one thing you recognize is that, yes, it's a function of time, so from 50s up to the 2000s, the CO2 keeps going up in the atmosphere. It keeps going up and down, and this is with the seasons. That's to say, most of the landmass of the world is in the northern hemisphere. And so in the springtime, the planet takes a deep breath, right? All those plants that are springing up imbibe CO2. And then in the wintertime, since there's not quite as much vegetation, all those plants breathe out. And consequently, there's an annual fall and rise in CO2 levels. Again, very, very worrisome if you look at the boreal forests and them dying off. this indeed, if the planet is not breeding, will drastically rise up. But there's another thing that's striking about this particular graph. If you look from a side and look at the plateaus, call it, take a derivative of this line, you'll find there are a couple of plateaus in the rise. And it just so happens that these things happen to coincide with recent world events that slow down oil production. You know, like the oil crisis, late 70s, and here's the first Iraq war over here. So indeed, we are making a difference when it comes to CO2 levels, and some people will go ahead, we are going to burn up because of it. The greenhouse effect is actually good for us in part. Part being that without the greenhouse effect, the temperature on the Earth would be on average, I think around -4 Celsius, right? So we do need to trap some heat, but the matter of how much heat we want to trap is a good thing to ask. But I think besides, you know, burning up issue that greenhouse, you know, effect might be, and the well-being of a nation, there's a third reason why you might want to make a cheap source of energy. And that is, this is still the greenhouse effect, glaciers dying off. This is a glacier of Kilimanjaro that's going away. That's the edge of it. But the other one to look at is indeed this blackout, the blackout of the East Coast. And there's the same picture that Jim showed earlier. Here's the New York City skyline on that particular night of August 14th. And you can see a few lights, but this is due to candles and personal generators. The significance of it was that actually 256 power plants were offline that evening. And University of Maryland researchers recognized something the following day. They said, let's take a flight. Let's take a flight and take a look at the quality of the air 24 hours after the blackout occurred, after 256 plants went offline. And so this thing wasn't happening for 24 hours. And what they found out is that there's a large reduction of SO2, about 90% reduction, ozone, also significantly reduced, as well as the light scattering particulates went down by 70%. Why is this important? Well, you know, there are a fantastic number of illnesses that have recently been connected with the quality of the atmosphere that we happen to be breathing. So simply for health reasons, I think it's a good idea to come up with a renewable and non-polluting technology if you can come up with one. So I'll give you those three reasons for it as incentives to push. And then, indeed, solar technology gives us a great opportunity because if this is a 1 year of our use of energy, this is the 1 year of solar energy production, meaning the sun gives us this much energy shining on the planet, and this is how much we actually use by burning oil and coal and the rest. Indeed, in 1 hour of solar illumination, if we can collect all that energy at 100% efficiency, we would be able to power the planet for 1 year. So that's a pretty good trade-off. 1 hour of sunlight going away, 1 dark hour for the sake of 1 year of running the world. The other way to think about it that kind of worries me a little bit, in a single day of burning oil, we are burning oil that took about a century for the planet to accumulate. So it's the century of plants and birds and trees and so forth that get boiled down to oil. In a single day, we burn that. Well, that's not really sustainable, right? If you look in the long run, at least we are putting out a lot of CO2 that, you know, takes 200 years for CO2 to get absorbed by oceans. So anything we put up there, we really have to worry about how it's going to come back down. PVs then give us a good opportunity, and indeed, roughly speaking, you need to cover about 2% of the U.S. land with 10% efficient solar cells. So if you look at the, you know, who has the sunlight, well, clearly Arizona does fairly well with sunlight. This is a, call it a relative sunlight index. But most of the country doesn't do that badly. I mean, if you normalize everything to roughly what Colorado might get, everything else is within 20% up and down, except Seattle. Seattle is a little bit lower. That's on average. But, you know, okay, so we'll subsidize Seattle from other states. And indeed, you know, countries like Germany are indeed adopting a very robust solar technology industry. Nevertheless, here is the, call it the 3 terawatt chunk of land you might need to cover with solar cells to actually run. And then mentioned that it's comparable to all the tar that you lay down to make the roads. It's comparable to about, the area of cities in the United States. Think about 3% of the U.S. land. And so if you need to cover about half of the city areas, that's another way of thinking of it. You can also think about if you can lay these solar cells along the roads, right? There already are power lines right next to the roads, so you don't actually have to wire up too much, right? I mean, usually power lines go the same way the roads do, so if you can actually double the size of the road by putting solar cells nearby, That's not a bad way maybe of locating them. There are different ways you can think about actually placing them. And then the question is becomes on what do you actually use as a technology. I'm focusing primarily on the solid-state thin film technology or solid-state single crystal technology. And indeed, there are some fantastic solar cells out there. You know, this gallium phosphide, gallium arsenide, germanium multi-junction cells, 35% power conversion efficiency under 66 suns. This is great, you know, because you can use solar concentrators, essentially mirrors, to have a very small cell to operate in this very high performance. There isn't really enough gallium, though, in the world to make very large area utilization of these kinds of cells. So that's a little bit of a problem. The other cells you can think of, well, silicon clearly is very dominant, prominent, at least in the industry, right? And you can get with a single crystal 24%, polycrystalline, best cases, maybe 20%, best amorphous, maybe 10%. This is in the lab. And quality in production, these numbers might be 60% of the numbers you see up here, right, in a large-scale type utility. Other things to look at, and, you know, numbers can vary, but on the order of 8 to 10% is what Gretzel cells might be able to provide us. Again, the cost issues are significant ones when it comes to actually figuring out ways to scale this. And at least one company has chosen at this point, Konarka has looked into actually scaling up the production of Gretzel cells and found that because of the cost materials, it's really a challenge that is hard to take. Also, the liquid electrolytes are big things to look at. So how much does it actually cost to produce electricity? Again, these numbers are only meant to serve as a scale bars, roughly speaking. You know, roughly speaking, it's about four times more to make a kilowatt hour using solar than it is to use nuclear, than it is to use coal. And all these numbers, again, are random numbers in a little bit, because how do you actually count this? Well, you count the medical costs of miners, right, that contract black lung disease because they were mining. You know, do you put that in the cost of your coal production? Well, no, that's not actually what you off the grid pay. That's what Medicare, Medicaid pay for. In a distance, you pay in a different way. So the way you actually account the numbers, you really have to worry about them. But roughly speaking, if you can actually be commercially viable in solar technology, there are a couple of issues we need to do. One, we need to be able to grow the energy production in a solar technology about a factor of 1,000 right now to meet about 30% of U.S. needs. I'll show you that in the next graph. The other thing to look at is I'll show you here the shipments in megawatts per year. Indeed, they do go quite steeply up. They do go exponentially up, it seems. And similarly, the cost does go down as a function of year. Indeed, this is in not in scale dollars. So indeed, the dollar was more expensive back in 76 than it is today. So this actually does go fairly steeply down. This is from Mike Rogel, looking at the year and the annual PV production. Well, today we make about 14 acres of solar cells a day. If you actually want to run United States with solar technology, we need to make about 14,000 acres of solar cells a day. So we just need to boost up the production, assuming 10% efficient cells, whatever they are, silicon most likely, by about a factor of 1,000, not a big deal, in which point the cost should go down. And I guess I'll count on the fact that cost will go down by a factor of 4, maybe even 10, because of the scale-up of the industry. And, you know, if you actually do this, this might be on the order of a $3 trillion industry. It would eclipse the car production industry. So Detroit would have other stuff to do, for example. You know, so there are ways of thinking of this in an extremely positive way. To make this many cells, that's many, many jobs you can bring to United States, right? Or there's many, many ways of uplifting the world through the production of solar energy. All right, well, how do we actually get there? You need to think about high throughput. There is a company called Unisolar that looks at utilization of stainless steel foils that are coated with amorphous silicon cells. This is really impressive as a way of them making several miles of cells a day, right, on a 16-inch foil. Flexible structures, lightweight. You know, when you actually make a cell, that's only half the game. You have to actually mount it. And it turns out, you know, the steel and, you know, infrastructure for mounting the cell costs just about as much as the cell itself, roughly speaking. So it turns out that if you actually want to have a commercially viable cell, even if they are free, let's say making solar cells is free today, and you can have as many as you want, it will still cost more than coal because we don't have an infrastructure to mount them onto the metal structures to cover 300 by 300 mile area, and then to patrol that area for getting the defects out and running the wires and making sure the squirrels don't eat the cable, you know, these kinds of things. It's a humongous amount of infrastructure you have to upkeep. So these are fantastic challenges to look at, but again, through the scale-up is one of those things you can consider. The other thing to consider is, well, there are all these rooftops, and they happen to be slanted, and many of them point out the right way. So maybe one way of thinking of installing cells is indeed by mounting them onto roof tiles and essentially make them as a value-added proposition to the present building infrastructure. That might be a thing to do. Now, nevertheless, you do want to come up with ways of doing this roll-to-roll and large area type footprint for the production. I said Unisolar has a roll-to-roll production, but their cells are only about 7% efficient. To make it, call it, make sense to do solar technology, you want to have about 10% efficient cells. Evergreen Solar, indeed, has 12% efficient cells, and they're not roll-to-roll, but they're close to it, at least the closest thing I've seen. The technology has been started, invented by Ellie Sachs in mechanical engineering a while ago, when he was a graduate student. And indeed, what it entails is simply taking two ceramic strings and pulling them out of silicon melt. And as the strings get pulled, the silicon forms, call it a soap bubble, just a very thin film between the strings. And as the strings are being pulled out, the silicon cools down, solidifies, and forms a ribbon. And so in that fashion, this is the actual ribbon being pulled out of the silicon melt. You can, in this company, Evergreen Solar, in Marlborough, Mass., there are many of these machines that run. Here's a guy holding one of these 4-inch wide ribbons, maybe 16 feet tall ribbons. And then what you do, they're 300 microns thick, roughly speaking. And then what you do is you just slice them into 1-foot chunks. You laminate electrodes on top and the bottom, and you got yourself a solar technology that is 12% efficient. You also have to dope one of the sides, but that's just a matter of spraying and running it through the furnace. It's all done on a conveyor belt. It's extremely impressive technology. The present production in Marlborough is about 50 megawatts of solar cells a day. Now, we need for US 3 terawatts. So we are kind of far away from just Marlborough, Mass. On what we can do. But, you know, Germany is very excited about this technology, and they're actually starting a 13 megawatt factory in Germany. This is because the subsidies of the German government make a lot of sense for actually pushing solar. Now, what else is coming down the line? Well, there are many ways you can think about what might be coming down the line. I'll just highlight a couple of things. So Dongfeng has been looking at fibers, right? Well, how fantastically interesting to start thinking of changing the format of a substrate. Instead of using solid substrate, solid chunks that you have to mount, well, how about just using fibers that can be woven into fabrics? Indeed, you know, my shirt, as I walk around, might be able to power my PDA, or, you know, might be able to power my cell phone. Why not? I mean, there's plenty of energy that runs around, and with the work that's done in the electrical engineering department, the power needed for running these type of gadgets are smaller and smaller. It's actually, there is plenty of energy, as long as we are able to absorb it in our shirts, right? It will all be black shirts, but, you know. You might choose to color them by choosing special organic dyes to actually reflect a part of the spectrum. But nevertheless, a concept of being able to make a large area substrate by simply pulling at miles per minute long fibers is quite enticing. The other thing to consider is indeed a work that Mark Bolduc has shown a couple of years ago, looking at biological systems and saying, you know, we spend a lot of time thinking about how to make the optimal light absorber. Nature spent 4 billion years, you know, haphazardly making a very good light absorber, spinach being one of those plants that is fantastic in being able to absorb light, especially spinach that's harvested at the break of dawn, and it has to be 2 weeks old, I think. I forget now, but you can actually take spinach, put it in a blender, make a soup out of it, take that soup out, genetically engineer it a little bit to have a tag on the photosystem 1 that you'll extract out of the soup. And you have a genetically engineered tag so that you can orient every PS1 that lands on your ITO substrate the proper way, so that every one of them gives electron going up and hole going down, or vice versa. As a matter of fact, you can do this. You can make structures. This is a photo response from Mark's work compared to the absorption response of the photosystem 1. You see the two batch indicating that the photocurrent indeed is due to the fact that the light is absorbed in PS1 and then delivered, excitons are broken up somehow, and then delivered to the external circuitry, making a solid state structure, fantastically interesting structure, but utilizing biologically derived material sets that are antennas, engineered, call it, over 4 billion years through haphazard works of nature. And now we can just simply take it out and maybe make active structures out of them. Maybe. One day it might be. These cells are not very efficient as of today, but it's a start, and it's a very different way of paradigm of thinking about how to utilize biology and link it to electrical engineering. I'll focus though on these cells. These are nanostructured organic, inorganic PVs, where the advantage of these material sets, these nanostructured materials, really is in a very, very large absorption constant. The absorption constant of a nanomaterial due to the compression of the density of states, is it in a molecule or in a quantum dot, can be about 10 times larger than in a typical inorganic thin film. This is due to the large dipole moments that organics tend due to the quantum size effect. Now, the other thing you have an advantage of is you can choose the color you want to absorb. Now, as an electrical engineer, I can nonchalantly say, you know, chemists can make anything. And indeed, working with Mujibel Wendy and Tim Swager, Mark Thompson from USC beforehand, indeed, chemists are fantastically capable in being able to put atoms together and to make a specific molecule you want. Now, many of the molecules they give you will not work in electrical devices because of the stability issues, issues with photooxidation or issues with electrooxidation, or their resilience to high fields that might be inside the devices. Nevertheless, in principle, there are billions and billions of organic compounds or billions of compounds, and you should be able to make the ones you need, as long as you know what do you want. So if you actually go ahead and try making organic or organic nanorod or quantum dot cells, you'll find that the best numbers in the solid state might be on the order, might be on the order of 3 to 4%. And you are capitalizing this very large absorption constant. Well, why is that important? Well, it's important because I need very small amount of material in principle. And consequently, I can ask you what materials are abundant enough out there to coat the world with solar cells at the areas that we need. Well, the two that pop up are silicon, because we have a lot of sand, and carbon, because we have it a lot in a crust, in the Earth's crust. Silicon, if you put all the silicon wafers we've used from 1960s till today, and say, from 1960s, if we converted all the silicon wafers into wafers that make solar energy, did we make enough silicon? And the answer is not by far. We didn't make enough silicon to run US, not by far, since 1960s. And that's because the silicon industry, as of today, is really geared towards making wafers that have a lot of very small devices on them. And the biggest wafers might be a foot in size, and that foot wafer might cost $1 million, right? Because you'll make many, many chips. Each one you'll sell $100, and it adds up to $1 million. So, you know, the actual production, call it, of silicon, although we know how to do it quite well, we really do not know how to do it on large area. Carbon, do we know how to process carbon on large areas? Do we know how to process conductors over large areas? Well, the answer is yes. You know, every plastic Coke bottle has a conductor on the outside, organic conductor or a metal oxide conductor on the outside of it. And there's a very simple reason for it, and that is that when the Coke bottles are labeled with a label that says Coke, well, the way they're doing that is they have these bottles and they go down the conveyor belt, the bottles rub against each other, charge up because they're plastic, spark between them, and scuff. And so as a consequence of it, if you had just a vanilla plastic bottle, by the time it was labeled, it would look all cruddy, like someone has, you know, scratched it all over because of all the sparks that would be flying between the non-conductive plastic bottles. So one thing we had to learn how to do is indeed put conductors over large areas, plastic bottles. We had to figure out how to coat potato chip bags, right? Every potato chip bag has aluminum thin film, a good electrode, right? That's really good. Every cockpit window of an airplane has a conductor because of all the rubbing force between the air and the airplane, again, will charge up. So indeed, we know how to put down conductors. We also are quite savvy in putting down organic materials in the form of film, right? I mean, Kodak, Polaroid, all those guys spend a long time thinking about putting down emulsions. Consequently, you can start dreaming and saying, you know, inkjet printer, what it does is print out organic semiconductors, organic dyes that could be actually used as organic semiconductors if you choose to. So in principle, we have the manufacturing schemes on how to process many of the organic materials and large area conductors that might be needed for electrodes. We have never implemented them towards electronics, and we also haven't reached the domain of very thin films on the order of maybe 0.1 microns in order to capitalize on the good performance of devices. But what you really need is really to understand how these devices work. You shine light, you generate an exciton, the exciton diffuses, and if it happens to diffuse to an interface, it can break up. As it breaks up, that electron hole can get delivered to the external circuit. The important thing, though, is having this interface and a heterodyne interface with a band offset to make it desirable for an electron to go one way and for the hole to go the other way. Indeed, that heterojunction is what runs the device. And the excitonic behavior, not just electronic, but excitonic behavior, it's what is going to determine the performance of your devices. So if you can optimize these devices, you actually can make some. This is a few years old now, but this particular device operates at about up to 17 suns if you choose to. This is under one sun operation and then up and up and up. The power conversion efficiency, about 3% internal power conversion efficiency. This particular device, it turns out, absorbs only a fraction of incident light, though, because it's very, very thin. And much of the light is left over for recirculation. Number 3% is when you account for the amount of light absorbed. Otherwise, this particular device actually, if you have it, it's only 1% efficient device with 1/3 light absorption. So you can then go ahead and say, well, here's my solar spectrum. What do I do to actually make devices? Outer organics, I always have to worry about how big of an offset do I need to break up my exciton. And if I say, well, this is the maximum power conversion efficiency as a function of the band edge of my materials, I can look at the particular band offset, this delta E, and I can say, well, how much of a delta E can I afford to have? If I want to have a 10% efficient homojunction, simply one junction, I want to have at least, well, the band offset cannot be any bigger than 0.5 eV. Most desirable, let's say we have about 0.3 eV band offset between the two in order to break up the exciton. In that case, having a 1 eV band gap material, I can reach, you know, 14% efficient cells in principle. So how far more can you go? Well, indeed, if instead of having just a single just cell, I have to have a whole series of cells, one after the other, with the idea that they're going to be able to absorb different parts of the spectra. A single junction here is at 15%, assuming that 0.3 eV offset. If I have two junctions, it's already at 19%. They have to be optimized so that one absorbs lower energies, another one absorbs higher energies, and on, with six cells in stack together, I might be able to make 27% on the paper efficient solar cells. How do I make these? Well, organic dyes or maybe nanocrystals. Indeed, this is if I ask you to go ahead and coat just a monolayer of these active species on a surface, you really don't need too many of them. And so now the game changes, and you can actually start thinking of using nanostructure materials as well. There are a variety of them you might choose in different regions, and this is just examples. Indeed, cadmium is likely not the one to choose because of the large area deployment, but we know how to make cadmium selenide quantum dots. There are other dots evolving in this visible region now that are more Earth-friendly that indeed would be viable. The attempts that we do in our lab, and I'll just take a couple of slides of it, is actually in understanding the processes that govern photodissociation inside these layered structures. And we choose to use quantum dots as the absorptive species because of the capability of fine-tuning the absorption spectrum. This is for cadmium selenide structures, looking at, from Muji Mawendi's group, looking at very small quantum dots, 2 nanometers in size, all the way to up to the ones that are 12 nanometers in size. And you can see this shift in the edge of the absorption spectrum. This is their luminescence, and you can use these for LEDs, which I'm not going to talk about today. But the importance is that we have a number of techniques now and a good set of knowledge over the past decade developed to actually start considering using these as active species in photodetecting structures. The idea of mixing quantum dots with polymers has been suggested before. This is in Paulo Losada's group. Looking at ways of putting down these quantum dots, we've actually done a lot of work for the sake of making quantum dot LEDs. And then the idea of taking these two together, coming up with a way to make a high throughput process, coming up with a way to make multiple layer structures, to make multiple diodes in series for that high efficiency. And there is some recent work that suggests carrier multiplication that is actually quite a bit in a bit of question on how to actually do that, or is it truly a physical process. Nevertheless, putting these things together, we went ahead and made the following types of structures. This is a structure consisting of an electrode, an electron on the other side, both ITO, and P-dot is an organic conductor that allows us to put down TPD in a uniform fashion. TPD is another organic material, just aromatic organic. We put down quantum dots, and the way we put down quantum dots is we ink an elastomeric stamp, PDMS, and simply press our substrate against it to pick up the dots. In this fashion, you can actually control exactly the thickness of the layers of dots you choose to have to deposit. And you can integrate the dots, which are typically solvent-based, with any other material that might otherwise be affected by the solvent. Our devices are not affected by the solvent, as manifested by the fact that you can actually leave them on a bench top for a few weeks, a few months, come back to measure them, and they'll perform the same way. On top of that, we actually sputter deposit indium tin oxide. This is at about 10 millitor, and you complete the device. You go ahead and measure it by shining some light on it. Depending on the color of the light, you're going to have a different amount of current that comes out. You go ahead and measure the absorption spectrum of the quantum dot. You measure the photoaction spectrum of the device. And indeed, there is a very nice correlation between the two, indicating that the device itself operates due to the absorption of light in the quantum dot's generation of excitons and breaking up of the excitons to generate photocurrent. The efficiency, if you account for the amount of light absorbed, which is small, because it's a very thin film, it's on the order of 9%. Now, this is how the current voltage, those of you who are electrical engineers in the audience, you actually want to see the IV curve. So this is current magnitude as a function of applied voltage across the device. In dark, I'm showing you two structures. One structure is just the one I just described, electrode, PPD, quantum dot layer, and ITO. The second structure misses the quantum dots for the sake of having a benchtop comparison between the two. In the dark, they look about the same. This is in reverse bias and forward bias. After you apply light, this is what you get. The quantum dot device gives you a significant amount of current due to the light shining. You can go ahead and evaluate the fill factor. It's on the order of about 0.4. That's the green line. But another thing you can learn very quickly is that you could say, well, okay, I have this device. It operates, clearly. It responds the way that I would expect to respond. But what part responds? How many of those quantum dots do absorb light, and how many of those quantum dots truly matter for operation of my device? And so what we've done here, and this is a very recent result, looking at the thickness of a quantum dot layer and looking at how much short circuit current do I get as a function of the decreasing thickness. And this is a little deceptive. This is a negative current. Short circuit current under photoelimination is always a negative current. The photo response of my device gets bigger the thinner my quantum dot film is. It's kind of weird. It says that the less light I absorb, the more photocurrent I'm going to get. But actually, it's very explainable, very simply explainable. Only one layer, or two maybe, of my quantum dot thick film are truly photoactive, the ones that are right next to the Kepler interface. The rest of the quantum dot layer, all it does is absorb light, and those excitons recombine without ever breaking up to give me photocurrent. And the one thing those extra layers of quantum dots do, they provide a resistor in series with my active device. And as a consequence of it, waste my power. So what's the lesson from it? Well, there are a couple of things you can do. If you want to use these as photodetectors, all you need to do is just apply some bias to pull out the other excitons. But if you want to use these as solar cells, we need to start thinking about using very large surface area solar cells. Because quantum dots have a large absorption constant, but if I use just a few monolayers of them, they are fairly transparent. And as a consequence of it, schemes of gathering light, capturing it, akin to Winston collectors, very simple planar Winston collectors, might be a way to go about it. Ways of putting these on top of silicon might be another thing to consider. Simply saying, you know, again, a lot of the silicon solar cell cost is actually in the substrate. Well, so maybe one thing you can do is put in series with silicon these, by putting these particular cells on top of silicon instead of glass, and to capture the infrared light that silicon lets go. These might be the fully conceivable teams to look in the future, but the basic physics is there. We understand it, and now we are looking at engineering schemes on being able to implement it. Last slide to just point to is simply the problems, then, if you look at it. Well, the biggest problem the solar cells have are batteries. Indeed, the sun shines only for a fraction of the day, and all the power conversion efficiencies you have and all the power production we cite is for the peak sunlight intensity. That happens maybe over 5 hours of the day. So as a consequence of it, what we need to do is capture the light during the 5 hours or 12 hours of sunlight and then store it. And then how do you store it? Well, you can put it in a dam, very inefficient when it comes to amount of kilowatts per kilogram. Lithium-ion batteries, better, but not that much better. The silica flywheels are about 10 times better, roughly speaking, lithium-ion batteries. Hydrogen, sure, chemical storage, or nuclear fusion, that does pretty well as well, but we don't quite know how to go from electricity to nuclear fusion quite yet. There are a couple of my colleagues who are considering it. So if we actually go ahead and then look at the challenges, the PV success requires cheaper batteries and cheaper solar cell fabrication that's amenable to the large area production. Let's finish with this slide and take any questions.
Do we have any questions for Vladimir? Yes.
I threw for a very broad question. Do you really need batteries, or could you instead just have really efficient power connectors? Because as we said, the light's shining somewhere on Earth. So rather than restoring it, why not just transmit it from a place where it's actually from?
No, we don't get too much electricity from California. Even when they have a surplus, is there is a finite resistance of copper lines. And the way that we went around that is that we increased the voltage on the lines and decreased the current to keep the power. But still, you have dissipated losses due to the current. And I do not know the equations off the top of my head, but I certainly would say that going even across the United States is not economically viable. We lose, I'll be wrong on this number, but I think we lose on the order of a quarter of our energy due to the power transmission. But it's a number. It's a number that is 10%, 20%, or 30%. I do not know the exact number in there.
The other quick question I had is it conceivable to have thin film type solar cells that are mechanically robust enough, not just put near the road, but just paved roads with solar cells?
Now, I'm excited about for that specific reason. I was excited by thermoelectrics as a possibility. Kids what the engine works on. Because, you know, asphalt absorbs a ton of heat.
Right.
And you might as well pave, do not pave. And, you know, there are more roads next to big cities, so you have more power production next to big cities. And there are more power, you know. It makes a lot of sense to combine, I call it at least, the infrastructure of the roads in some fashion, because it runs the power line anyhow nearby. The other, I don't know. I really do not know if there is a feasible way of considering that. Indeed, the benefit quality of organics might be the fact that they're shatterproof, right? Everything plastic is going to be really hard to shatter, and consequently they'll work longer. But that's just words, right? I mean, I don't have a good technology to show you in my hand that says this thing will last for 20 years, cars running over it, and will only make economic sense if they'll just pay me with asphalt, right? I mean, that's so much of what I've told you about, I think, is a big dream, and a big dream that I think is quite conceivable if you can reach a couple of important metrics: stability, robustness of material sets. It has to be placed in the context of the economic sense. And the other thing that has to make sure that you don't lose track of is the fact that we have these big milestones, call it significant achievements we should invent. That's what our job is. And the significant achievements that we should invent is indeed in ways of deploying these, the ways of utilizing them in conjunction with the present technologies, and then maybe displacing the present technology simply because of the cheap, I'll call it, economic factors that might come through because of the new technology being reinvented. I think there's plenty of things to be done there. But the one thing I think they also have to be very realistic about, and companies, many companies out there, because the VC climate is so rich with money, and they're looking to invest money, there are at least, you know, three or four nanotechnology, solar technology companies out there. I'm not sure that any of them has actually shown a physical cell, at least I'm not aware, a physical cell, and has characterized it for the longevity and has reached the performance level of even 5% over operation over a few years. So these are, call it, the really big things to look at when, call it the red herrings when you start dreaming about this technology. I think, on the other hand, there is much to be said about dreaming about it, because I think our job is to come up with the ways of integrating them together in the long run.
Yeah.
The quantum dots, just because of their nice absorption profile, have you made a tandem cell with two? You have this TPD, which is sort of the OLED run backwards, I guess.
Yeah.
And so have you made a tandem cell, and does it scale like you would expect with the open circuit voltage, or is there something hidden there?
So I haven't made quantum dots. My colleagues have followed my work that I've shown on organics back down in Princeton, and they laid down 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 organic cells in series. and the open circuit voltage does add up. You have to be careful about making sure you get generally the same amount of current in each cell. Because the cells are semi-transparent, it's kind of ideal. You can actually, in their specific case, they use the same kind of cell just three times because they have partial absorption in each level. They have a metal mirror that reflects the exponential curve back down. So when you add the front and the reflected, roughly speaking, you get about the same amount of illumination. And you can boost the efficiency about fourfold by using four cells. So efficient, you get much higher open circuit voltage, lower short circuit current, but not by much. So it does work as an idea, but it hasn't reached numbers. I believe the best organic cells are on the order of 8% today in solid state. And that is quite intricate, many, many layers kind of put together rather than, say, self-assembled quantum dots and a robust structure.
Other questions? Okay, why don't you join me in thanking Vladimir and also our previous speakers.